Tired of spills and stains on your sofa? Wash away your worries with Anabe. Anabe is the only machine washable sofa inside and out, where designer quality meets budget-friendly prices. That's right, sofas start at just $699. Enjoy a no-risk experience with pet-friendly, stain-resistant, and changeable slip covers made with performance fabric. Experience cloud-like comfort with high-resilience foam that's hypoallergenic and never needs fluffing. The sturdy steel frame ensures longevity, and the modular pieces can be rearranged anytime. Shop washablesofas.com for early Black Friday savings, up to 60% off site-wide, backed by a 30-day satisfaction guarantee. If you're not absolutely in love, send it back for a full refund. No return shipping or restocking fees. Every penny back. Upgrade now at washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I am Gaius in Londinium. Germanicus is here with me. The Centurions are pulling their chairs up for another entertaining round of what is going to come of the Roman Empire in the first century AD that is either substantial or fleeting or dangerous in the 21st century AD in the inheritor of the Roman institutions, the United States of America and its empire. That is the question we put before the centurions. Remember, they're heartened, their 25 years of service. They're now living in Londinium on lands that they bought and they farm. That service is meant to be sustaining the empire, and they want to know that 2,000 years from now, it will still be honored, and we believe it will be. But what we've discovered over the last years in this conversation we have by the Thames, which is extremely turbulent tonight. I wouldn't want to cross that Thames in a small boat. Very choppy, wintry-like. Conditions are various any day, any hour of the day. In any event, by the Thames in Londinium, we believe that the institutions will hold up in the 21st century, and they're now coming under extreme challenge. Germanicus, the challenge is outside the borders of the United States and inside. We'll start with outside because we've been following the Russian aggression against Ukraine for years. The episode that most strikes me now is not what will happen in Ukraine. It's what's happening along the NATO frontier. I'm told reliably again and again that any provocation such as the shoot down of a Russian warplane or the blockading of the Russian shadow fleet will put Mr. Putin in a quandary. It is not his peaceful compatriots. It's his right wing. They're not just nationalists. They believe that he's supervised a very bad war, and they want it done. And any provocation whatsoever, he's been told, he will be removed, and they will take charge. He's been told this again and again. No one's planning on provoking Russia along the NATO frontier. Accidents happen routinely. And we've seen some hotheads in NATO. We've seen some hotheads in the European Parliament. We also have appeasers, National Rally in France, AFD in Germany, Farage in Britain, some appeasers. I don't look to any particular scenario, just that I think we have to take into account that Putin is driven by his right wing. He might joke about being the Tsar. He might joke about being the hard one, but he's not. He's the leader of a country that is bitter about NATO, bitter about the United States, bitter about the way it's been treated since the Soviet Union collapsed at the end of 91. And the leaders in that country want not revenge. They want to be recognized as mistreated. They want to be treated with respect. These are all conditions that apply not to 1939, but 1914. That's how I see it right now. No one wants to go to war.
Right.
But dignity requires it. How do you see it, Germanicus? You have much better vision of Moscow than I do.
Well, I feel that Russia is more like the U.S. than we are willing to hazard. Rather than a czar, Putin is a Kaiser, you know, a Caesar, like the emperor in Washington, D.C., who is also styles himself a Caesar. The other power centers that you mentioned in Russia really are their equivalent of the Senate. And in the U.S., of course, the Senate is not simply the legislative body we call the Senate. It is the billionaires and other centers of power in the U.S. And so he is, to some extent, in a position where he has to be careful. And the vast majority of Russians support the war, so it isn't just the right wing that would be upset if he made a big misstep, like agreeing to the terms that Mr. Trump offered him, which would be unacceptable to the vast majority of Russians. He has to pull out a big victory at this point. And I think he fairly deftly handled Mr. Trump's offers, various offers. And he has been responding in the last few days in ways that show a kind of control over what he can do to both keep the West at bay and to some extent cowed, but also satisfy his own Senate and people. And so just the other night, he launched the largest missile attack on the Ukrainian electrical grid. And it's very interesting because it's becoming clear that the focus of Russia, meaning Putin's general staff and Mr. Putin himself, the focus is not to destroy electrical generation in Ukraine, which would put the whole nation at risk with all the elderly on the brink. It would be seized by the West and, you know, Western media as the specter of another Holodomor. And that would not help his cause or Russia's at all. However, with the European grandstanding and threatening, and also the other day, European parliamentarians basically announcing that they're in a long twilight struggle with Russia that will last decades until it is brought to heel. He has to have some way of preventing a Western provocation or escalation that would lead to an impossible situation for him. So in many ways, the kind of campaign that he's waged against the electrical grid and generation in Ukraine is very smart because he's bringing it just to the brink and basically saying, well, if you have a provocation, I can knock out the whole grid and then look at what will happen then. And he also is saying, rather obviously, that the scale of these attacks, the one the other day was enormous, basically demonstrates that if NATO were to really seriously provoke Russia with the examples you gave, then Russia could respond. If NATO really wanted to go to war, it would be really devastating what Russia could do to NATO as they are doing to Ukraine. So he's got that under control. The big problem that he's facing now is how to successfully bring about a victorious termination of the war. And in some ways, the stage has been set in the last several weeks. To do that, quickly, in the sense that the diminishing capacity of Ukrainian armed forces, their thinness on the battlefield across the front, the line of contact, and the great success that Russian forces have had, the fall of Pokrovsk, Kupiansk, et cetera, really gives him an opportunity to collapse the Ukrainian war effort. But that's going to take some effort, and it's not guaranteed that he can do that quickly. I mean, within the next several months. So he's got to maintain the kind of push now to achieve that, and at the same time be able to deter the West, and especially Mr. Trump, from coming in hard against him. And so he is already in a difficult situation, but not nearly as difficult as either Kiev or the whole of NATO, which is essentially undercut their economies to prosecute this proxy war against Russia. Germany's been deindustrializing. They're on the brink of recession or already in recession. Certainly France is. This becomes a harder enterprise to push for Europe, and by extension, by the U.S. And so, I tend to think that he is in a position to end the war and then be a hero and join the ranks of other Russian heroes in history, whether it's, you know, Kutuzov or Peter the Great, et cetera, et cetera. And then that will take the pressure that he's under now off of his back.
1914. I reviewed it again. Sarajevo is meaningless to them for weeks. Meaningless. And in fact, some in the empire thought getting rid of him actually cleared things up for succession. And he was a bother. And there was difficult. No alarm bell in Moscow. There was no in Petersburg. There's no alarm bell in Paris in those early weeks after the assassination. What turned it was that everybody considered that the war between Austria and Serbia needed to be cleaned up. And Austria was the one to do it. And at first, that didn't bother people. It's a small war. We don't care. Serbia won't last long. But then they started to mobilize, and it tumbled. It was no longer about Sarajevo. It was about, we must be ready. We can't not respond to the half mobilization or the mobilization over there. And then the Germans felt surrounded. If we wait now, they'll get stronger. And that is the tumble down the stairs that doesn't have one driver. What is it, more than 100 years later, and we still don't have the reason it happened?
My sense when it comes to the July crisis emerging as it did is that the demands Austria made on Serbia would have amounted not simply to a humiliation of Serbia, but also to Russia. And Russia was at that point, you know, emotionally bound to Serbia, and we're not willing to take what would have amounted to a kind of humiliation for Russia if Austria was able to bring Serbia to heel. And that is a problem. I don't think the pride involved is an intense variable. And if we look at the pride today within Russia, they're not going to concede. But then, you know, that possibility was eluded by Mr. Putin when he essentially escaped the NATO trap of freezing the line of contact in a ceasefire. And by saying, no, we're not going to compromise, because that would have really done him in. But I think a big NATO provocation, were it to happen, would almost demand a powerful Russian response. And I brought up the whole issue of the electrical grid of Ukraine, but that knocking that out completely as a response might not be enough, and it would put Russia in a difficult position internationally. So they might have to do a tit for tat, and that's how things slide, because things begin to unravel, and politicians feel that they can't be allowed to be shamed by the enemy.
Germanicus, Washington thinks it has to win.
Well, when you say Washington thinks it has to win, you mean the neocons think they have to win. I'm not sure where the Democrats are now, because as we'll discuss, the Democrats are all wrapped up now in the fight at home.
Trump is seen as an appeaser by the Democrats.
Pardon me?
Trump is seen as an appeaser by the Democrats.
Well, they, of course, wanted to continue what Mr. Biden was doing.
Yes.
They will, but I mean, I think they're really distracted now. They can try and do something with Ukraine if Mr. Trump falters, but there isn't the same kind of ardor in the Democratic Party, because the Democratic Party is split, just as the Republicans are, and you have a progressive wing now that is not into the war in Ukraine.
So. Let me give you the choice. Conceding that Ukraine is torn apart or going for the win, what's Washington going to choose?
My sense is that they're going to have to take it unless they want war with Russia.
Okay.
Now, look at it this way. I talked about Putin trying to wrap up the war. Wrapping up the war means a big breakthrough, because the Ukrainian ranks are so thin and the Russian have such a facility on the battlefield and such strength. And Kiev, you know, the whole war effort is collapsing. That's a crisis. And that could be comparable to the July crisis in 1914. If people in the West lose their heads, especially Mr. Trump. But I just don't think that the West is prepared to go to world war at this point.
Did they in July of 1914?
Right. So, as you say, it's always a possibility.
We can't see it. We're just looking at analogies. The centurions are restless. We don't have a call for you guys, okay? We don't. On July 4th, 1914, in America, they couldn't see a war. They couldn't see it. Nobody could see it July 4th. And yet, by August, what is it? The lights are going down all over Europe, and they won't be lit again?
In our lifetime, yes. Thank you, Earl Grey. Lord Grey. I mean, here's the reason I don't think it'll happen, is that Democrats would rather that Russia win and make Trump look like a loser and a fool. That would give them extra oomph for 26. If they go to world war, they're going to have to support Trump as the war president.
Putin he's at war with NATO. That's what Putin says.
Yeah, of course. But if NATO and Russia go to war, the U.S. has to join in.
All right. I see five times possibilities of chaos, one possibility of peace. How many do you see?
I see it in reverse. I see there the lots of ways in which the turmoil in U.S. domestic politics and the weakness in Europe make it almost impossible to have a war because of the nature of the dynamics. Everything favors the Democrats if Trump is seen as the loser of a war, which is exactly what they would do if he did nothing and Mr. Putin brought an end to the war on Russia's terms. So they're not going to want to go to war at this point, because the days of acclamation of Zelensky in Congress by the Democrats and the blue fervor has evaporated.
Let's move to the domestic, where there's also threat of major league tumult. Michael Vlahos is Germanicus. I am Gaius, John Bachelor. We're in Londinium. It's 91 AD. We're very far from the troubles in Rome, thankfully. Londinium is the Roman version of London. It will fade away into bricks and stones and things buried by the Thames in another 300 years and won't emerge before the 11th century, again, after Hastings, as the center of civilization. We're aware of this, and yet after it emerges in the 11th century, with the Normans in charge, it leads the world in building an empire in the 18th and 19th century. We inherited that empire. The British Empire, the English Empire, the one built up by London after Hastings, is democracy and the republic and transparency and the courts. That is at risk. Not by Moscow, but hypothesis by Washington. When we come back, this is Friends of History Debating Society. We're in Londinium. We're going to the theater later. More revenge cycle. I'm John Batchelor.
We know no one's journey is the same. That's why Delta SkyMiles moves with you. From earning miles on reloads for coffee runs, shopping, and things you do every day, to connecting you to new experiences, a SkyMiles membership fits into your lifestyle, letting you do more of what makes you, you. It's more than travel. It's the membership that flies, dines, streams, rides, and arrives with you. Because when you have a membership that's as unique as you are, there's no telling where your journey will take you next. Learn more at delta.com/skymiles.
Hey, it's me, your heart. Mind if I pick the next song? Listen, even though we're eating better, people who've had one heart attack are at higher risk of another. But Repatha Evolocumab plus a statin lowers LDL-C, our bad cholesterol, and our heart attack risk. So let's talk to our doctor about Repatha.
Do not take Repatha if you're allergic to it. Serious allergic reactions can occur. Get medical help right away if you have trouble breathing or swallowing, swelling of the face, lips, tongue, throat, or arms. Common side effects include runny nose, sore throat, common cold symptoms, flu or flu-like symptoms, back pain, high blood sugar, and redness, pain, or bruising at the injection site. View the important safety information in our banner. Listen to your heart. Ask your doctor about Repatha.
Ah, greetings from my bath, festive friends. The holidays are overwhelming, but I'm tackling this season with PayPal and making the most of my money, getting 5% cash back when I pay in four. No fees, no interest. I used it to get this portable spa with jets. Now the bubbles can cling to my sculpted but pruny body. Make the most of your money this holiday with PayPal. Save the offer in the app.
Ends 12/31. See paypal.com/promo terms. Points can be redeemed for cash and more. Pay in four, subject to terms and approval. PayPal Inc. and MLS 910457.